says a former dictator personally approved talks between Iraq and bin Laden in the 1990s. Former spokesman and advisor of the former Coalition Provisional Authority in Iraq joins us now. Dan Senior is a Fox News contributor. This is the Bush lied story. No WMDs, no connection with bin Laden, no connection with 9/11, no connection with any attacks on the United States. And now these documents are saying, yes, all that's true. Can we believe these documents?
Well, you look back, actually, it's interesting. The State Department had listed for about two decades Saddam Hussein's Iraq as a state sponsor of terrorism, as a government that had ties to terrorist groups. For a couple decades, people forget, the State Department listed it on their website. So the operational ties between terrorists, whether it's Al-Qaeda or not, goes way back. These documents look like they have increasing credibility. The question is, will the administration get out there and really make the case
for
them?
Does the administration have to?
Well, I think the administration wants to stay away from relitigating this issue and this debate because it implies that they're trying to link 9/11 with Saddam Hussein.
Well, I've read these documents. ABC News is putting these things out. It's not some nut job.
Fox News never stopped. The documents were handwritten with no official seal. Now, how authentic is that? Just about as authentic as the forged documents by the CIA on the Iraqi Niger uranium situation. That was basically a CIA setup for Boy George and Company as payback. There's no operational relationship in reality, as we all know, and as real information has outlined, ever between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda. Unless you're saying that Al-Qaeda is really basically part of the CIA. And then again, if that's the case, then, well, there is a link. Saddam, CIA, Al-Qaeda. Just a few nuts, playing war games against one another. Here's a true war game for the mind. Slave Revolt. Check it. Listening to 103.3. FreakRadio.org with Skid in Santa Cruz. 104.1. 96.3. 107.5. Antelope Valley. PropagandaPress.org. LUVER.com. The world. RadioForAll.net. The universe. Of course, click into the slave web. Just go slaverevoltradio.blogspot.com. Find out what time it is tonight. We're going to step back into the year of 1876 and explore another diabolical fix. 103.3, Slave Revolt.
Attention, seekers everywhere. I was right. Everything I knew was wrong.
You see, where they've gone, they're playing with the universe. They're playing with the solar system. But they have no perception and no way to measure what the amount of energy that's going to flow out from that light off is going to
American experiment has been an experience of violence, takeover, slavery, usurpation, and fraud. The fairly recent 2000 presidential sham election is nothing new in the American scene. In this Beyond the Shadow segment called An American Fraud Every Century, we're going to explore with Roy Morse Jr., author of the book Fraud of the Century, about the stolen elections of 1876. This was the presidential election between Rutherford Hayes, Republican, versus Samuel Tilden, Democrat. Let's explore some of these dynamics that took place and some of the things and events leading up to this, to give a backdrop of the period and the scandal and the issues that the then President Grant was under. So let's check this out, step by step.
In front of the President, Ulysses S. Grant officially opened the Centennial Exhibition on May 10, 1876, and he didn't get a particularly warm welcome that day. It was the tail end of the Grant administration, and the American people as a whole had grown increasingly tired of the seemingly endless succession of scandals emanating from Washington in the past 8 years. These included, among other things, Black Friday, in which Grant's good friend Jay Gould tried to corner the nation's gold market, the credit mobile scandal, in which various senators and congressmen were bribed by the Union Pacific Railroad to give them a free right-of-way across country during the building of the Transcontinental Railroad, the whiskey ring, in which whiskey distillers and various corrupt officials combined to defraud the government of millions of dollars of uncollected taxes, and the Belknap bribery scandal, in which Grant's own Secretary of War, William Belknap, was forced to resign from office for taking kickbacks from traders of various Indian reservations in the West. Somewhat optimistically, Grant wanted to run for a third term of office, but the various scandals and also a major depression in 1873 that put 3 million Americans out of work effectively ruined his chances of doing so. Instead, the Republican Party nominated a comparative dark horse, Ohio Governor Rutherford B. Hayes, for president, and the Democrats, as expected, nominated New York Governor Samuel Tilden. Both Hayes and Tilden were personally untouched by scandal. In fact, Tilden had been elected governor of New York 2 years earlier, primarily on the strength of being a crusading reformer. As head of the state Democratic Party in New York, Tilden had led the efforts to bring down Boss Tweed and the corrupt Tammany Hall patronage machine before the Tammany Hall could bring down the entire Democratic Party along with it. Whether this was motivated by simple good citizenship or political self-preservation, probably a little of both, Tilden nevertheless was considered a rising star in the Democratic Party, and it gave him a ready-made platform on which to run for president 2 years later. Reform also played a major role in Hayes' selection. He more or less backed into the nomination after the prohibitive favorite, Maine Congressman James G. Blaine, had been implicated in a scandal of his own involving some shady railroad stock transactions just prior to the Republican convention, which, conveniently enough for Hayes, was held in his adopted hometown of Cincinnati. Hayes also had the built-in advantage of being independently wealthy, since he had inherited a good deal of money from a rich uncle. So there were no inconvenient financial skeletons rattling around in his closet.
So as you can see, not much has changed. Here you have a situation where in the aftermath of the Civil War, you had Republicans be in position, you know, following in Lincoln's footsteps of presidential power. So you have like Grant, who was currently president during this period leading up to the 1876 election. And in typical privatized order fashion, extreme cronyism is taking place. In the scandals, as Morris was talking about, congressmen bribed by railways, whiskey bribes, kick back the traders on Indian reservations, so they're pulverizing the native aboriginals, but at the same time exploiting the market privatized system that was built in these concentration camp funded institutions of death for the natives. And you had the major depression of 1873. 3 million people in America were just knocked out of work. Now, this kind of corresponds with the next aspect of what then took place. If you remember, the 1873 was America's great, great, deep depression. And in many of the newspapers at the time, they openly talked about how the capitalists, the greedy bankers, the railway men plunged the country into its Great Depression. A depression that some thought they may not even be able to pull out of. Now, how was the what was the response by the political social engineers and by many of the public on how to pull out of the depression? Invade the Black Hills. A Red Cloud had previously fought the Christian invaders to more or less a standstill, to the point where the Indians of the Dakotas were awarded, or they were quote unquote allowed to maintain their own property in the Dakota region. And this included the Black Hills. And what then took place, though, was a situation where this sovereignty from the encroachment of the white manifest destiny was only a temporary thing, because under the whole market system that has its own imperializing expansionist methodology to it, when the folks in the newly occupied territories of the Americas plunged themselves in their own system into depression and chaos, their response was to send George Armstrong Custer, he really was nothing more than a colonel, into the Black Hills to basically go on an excavation mission. What it really meant was they always knew that there were large gold deposits in the Black Hills. And with the country in its dire economic situation as a result of the greedy capitalists, it was time to make a move of exploitation and occupation into and expand the region of the Americas. This is exactly what happened. Old Custer declared that gold was found in the Black Hills, not unexpectedly, of course, and messages were sent to Indians in the free quote-unquote territory telling them that they must now reside themselves into prefabricated concentration camps, or they will basically face the wrath of the 7th Cavalry of George Armstrong and his crew and others. This set off the next chain of events that led to a great day in American history, the massacre of George Armstrong, Custer, 7th Cavalry, and others. But it also, in the end, set up a major collapse in the end of the sovereignty of the Lakota Sioux and others in that region, who were willing to put up the major battle that defeated Custer. I'm, of course, talking about Sitting Bull, Two Moon, Crazy Horse, Touch the Clouds, Rain in the Face, Gall, Little Big Man, and on and on. So here you have a situation where, in the same way that this empire currently sucks the blood and resources off of people internationally to keep its barbaric boat of death floating, is the same way in its early expansionist period. It did the same. Now, at the same time, another internally situation was going on that was causing much problems within the American experience amongst another group of captivated souls, Africans enslaved as Americans, or something like that. Here's a little bit from the Fraud of the Century that says some of the situations that the then Grant administration found itself in. I'll go into some of this. The myriad sins of the Grant administration, however, limited their effect on the public at large, prevented it from focusing on a more pressing problem, one that affected everyone. That problem was race. From the moment of its inception, the shadow of slavery hung over the nation like a pall, shrouding every aspect of American life. 600,000 soldiers had died in the Civil War, contesting, amongst other things, the continued viability of slavery as a social and financial institution. The North had won. The slaves had been freed, quote unquote, by me. And the 14th and 15th Amendment to the Constitution had rendered to black men, if not black women, all the privileges of American citizenship, including, most importantly, the right to vote, giving blacks portentous numbers in the South and their expected fidelity to the Republican Party. This abrupt political empowerment had resulted in a momentous shift in the balance of power between the two parties. As long as federal troops propped up friendly Republican governments in the South, blacks held their balance in the wandering hands. Quote, bottom rail on top rail now, massa, unquote, one former slave said to his former owner, and in that simply homely was encapsulated any number of complex truths. For more than a decade after the Civil War, the struggle to define, expand, codify, and protect the political rights of 700,000 newly freed slaves in the South had dominated the national agenda. It was a struggle linked inextricably, if uneasily, to the larger question of how to bring the rebellious Southern states back into the Union, while at the same time vilifying the gains, social, racial, financial, and political, that 360,000 Northern soldiers had died to achieve. Taken together, the ongoing efforts came to be known as Reconstruction, and they brought out the worst, and less frequently the best, in the American character. Even before the war was over, the political reconstruction of the South had begun. As part of his plan to reintegrate the Southern states into the Union, Abraham Lincoln, in December 1863, had offered to grant full pardons and restore all rights, quote, except as to slaves, unquote, to any Southerner willing to take a loyalty oath. When the number of loyal men in any state equaled 10% of the total number of voters who had participated in the last pre-war election in 1860, that state could then establish a new government and send a fresh slate of senators and representatives to Washington, subject to the approval of Congress. The only stipulation was that the state officially abolish slavery in its constitution. No provision had to be made regarding the future voting rights of the, quote, laboring, landless, and homeless class, unquote, of former slaves living precariously within its borders. Lincoln's plan, which was swiftly embraced by pro-Union voters in the occupied portions of Arkansas and Louisiana, infuriated Northern radicals in Congress. By failing to make black suffrage a primary requirement for a state's re-entry into the Union, the plan, quote, freed the slave and ignored the Negro, unquote, said abolitionist Wendell Phillips. Without the power of the vote, the radicals warned, freedmen and their families would have no protections from the, quote, unrepentant rebels, unquote, who were poised to control the Southern governments. Two leading radicals, Ohio Senator Benjamin Wade and Maryland Congressman Henry W. Davis, introduced a counterproposal to Lincoln's plan in 1864. The Wade-Davis bill required a much stronger ironclad oath of loyalty by Southerners. Anyone who had served in the Confederate Army was disqualified from taking the oath and receiving a pardon. The bill also required that 50% of all qualified voters, not the 10% mandated in Lincoln's amnesty proclamation, ratify any new proposed state government. Although both houses of Congress passed the Wade-Davis bill, Lincoln angrily refused to sign it, noting that in general, quote, there is too much disposition in certain quarters to hector and dictate to the people of the South to refuse to recognize them as fellow citizens. Such persons have too little respect for Southerners' rights. I do not share feelings of that kind, unquote. In retaliation, the Lincoln pocket veto, Massachusetts Senator Charles Sumner organized a filibuster to block the seating of Louisiana new senators in February of 1865. Quote, the pretended state government in Louisiana, unquote, he charged, quote, is a mere 7 months of abortion begotten by the bayonet in criminal conjunction with the spirit of the caste and born before its time, rickety, unformed, unfinished, whose continued existence will be a burden, a reproach, and a wrong, unquote. The filibuster seceded and the new senators remained unseated. After Lincoln's assassination in April 1865, his successor, Andrew Johnson, a native-born South Carolinian who had grown up in Tennessee, attempted to follow Lincoln's lead by giving political power back to the same Southern whites who had lost it, at least temporarily, on the crimson battlefields of the Civil War. Under Johnson's plan, called Presidential Reconstruction, the 11 states of the late Confederacy were empowered to organize new governments, hold constitutional conventions, and elect their own legislators. The only Southerners prohibited from voting were former Confederate government officials and the wealthiest 1% of the planter class, and even they could petition Johnson individually for a pardon. Despite having threatened earlier to, quote, punish and impoverish, unquote, the leaders of the rebellion, Johnson soon began granting pardons to thousands of Southern aristocrats who, one critic charged, quote, like the Bourbons, have learned nothing and forgotten nothing, unquote. Once a sworn foe to the plantocracy, quote, unquote, they dominated pre-war Southern politics. Johnson proved even more magnanimous in victory than Lincoln had been. By August 1866, Despite horrifying race riots in Memphis and New Orleans, the president felt justified in announcing that peace, quote, peace, order, tranquility, and civil authority now exist in and throughout the whole of the United States, unquote. Congressional radicals in the North, to say nothing of their black and white supporters in the South, begged to disagree. The newly empowered Southern legislators, with the tacit approval of the president, had begun enacting a number of repressive new laws called Black Codes, aimed at controlling the vast labor pool of the former slaves. The Black Codes varied from state to state, but their intent was the same: to force black workers back onto the plantation by limiting their freedom of movement and requiring them to work cheaply for their old master or else face legal prosecution as vagrants. There were, to be sure, some provisions in the codes granting freedmen minimal civil liberties, including the right to marry, own property, and serve on strictly segregated juries. But the chief aim of the codes, as South Carolina politician Edwin Rhett explained all too frankly, was to ensure that the newly freed blacks, quote, be kept as near to the condition of slavery as possible and as far from the condition of the white man as practicable, unquote. Florida Governor William Marvin condescendingly advised the freedmen to forget about the vote, return to the plantation, and, quote, call your old master, master, unquote. By passing the Black Codes, revanchist Southern legislators gave added weight to the radicals' call for stricter federal supervisions and inadvertently dealt a death knell to presidential reconstruction. At the same time, they lent added urgency to Republican efforts to reorganize the South as a truly biracial two-party society. The Reconstruction Act of 1867 was designed to do just that. Passed over Johnson's fruitless veto, the act dissolved the new provisional legislatures, disqualified thousands of former Confederates from voting or holding office, and divided 10 of the 11 former Confederate states into military districts governed by U.S. Army generals. States could petition for readmittance to the Union only after they had held new constitutional conventions ratifying the recently enacted 14th Amendment, with prohibited states from discriminating legally against any citizen on the basis of their race. Tennessee, which had already ratified the amendment, was exempted from the act. The states were also required to officially repudiate the Confederate war debt and grant universal suffrage to all ineligible male voters, black and white. 20,000 soldiers were sent back into the South to enforce the law and preserve the peace. Their primary mission, said Charles Sumner, was to ensure, quote, the application of morals to an administration of public affairs. So here you can see some of the dynamics that were taking place, because those who were the former planters and part of the orthodoxy rulers within the South wanted to maintain their domination and privilege over their black caste crew, and they were willing to use any means. It has nothing to do with justice, any forms of what they call democracy, bourgeois democracy, or otherwise. It has nothing to do with honor. It has everything to do with exploitation and domination, manipulation for control of various forms of resources. And for black folks, that resource was their bodies, because their resource was their labor. So this helps highlight also some of the dynamics that are often ignored too, about Lincoln and what he was proposing and all of that, because by, of course, having, as I've gone into before, like on my commentary, Happy 4th of July, It Ain't Our Independence Day, how Lincoln's main priority was to maintain the Union. That was his main priority. Once again, you could see how Lincoln was playing up to the South and basically was saying, have with the Negroes as you wish. Because his main priority was maintaining the Union. And thereby, that helped play into the super edge of exploitation that the dogs of the South were still deeply committed to. And the resistance that started to take place against blacks was incredible. It wasn't just the known legendary terrorist group, the Ku Klux Klan. There were many organizations, the Black Cavalry, the Red Shirts, the White Brotherhood, Men of Justice, Knights of the White Camellia, Constitutional Union Guard, the White Line, the Rising Sun. These were all these subhumanoid, vicious terrorist groups. Many of them were ballyhooed by the whole religious right-wing Fuhrer. Even before the Civil War, a cornerstone of white ideology was this whole, especially out of the Baptist white church, of their right and to dominate, and that they were on the side of God. You know, a few years back, the Southern Baptist Church apologized for the role that it played in slavery. And that has to do with a lot of the documents, if you look at how they intertwine slavery with the religious Fuhrer, and they intertwined in the righteousness of the morality of the Southern way of life, and tried to counterpose it to the North and anyone who went outside of that way. So you had many people in the South indoctrinated with this kind of, we are not only like God's chosen people, but we are on the right course. And those who have the nerve to come up against us are following the path of the beast. Now, here's some background on both Hayes, the Republican, and the Democrat Tilden, who are running for a president in the upcoming election of 1876. Check this.
At the time of the election, Hayes was 53 years old and serving his third term as governor of Ohio. He was the first man to be elected governor of Ohio three times. Prior to that, he had been a congressman for two terms. And during the Civil War, despite having no formal military training, he rose to brigadier general and subsequently took part in a number of bitter battles, particularly in the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia. He was wounded four times during the war, making him our most wounded president. He nearly lost an arm and died from one wound suffered at the Battle of South Mountain just prior to Antietam in September 1862. Hayes was a graduate of Kenyon College and Harvard Law School and had been city attorney of Cincinnati for several years prior to the war. He was married to a strict abolitionist and teetotaler named Lucy Webb, who came from their hometown of Delaware, Ohio. Lucy was the first college graduate to become a first lady. And after Hayes became president, she became famous in her own right as Lemonade Lucy for banning alcohol from official White House functions. In fact, it was said that the water flowed like wine at the White House. Samuel Tilden was 62 at the time of the election. Unlike Hayes, he was a bachelor. And during the campaign, there was some not-so-subtle whispering that he was gay. There was no evidence of this. Tilden was a very private individual, but his campaign managers were so worried about the rumors that they leaked word to the press that after the election, he was planning to get married. In fact, so many different women were suggested as his possible fiancée The one Republican newspaper joked that he must also be planning to become a Mormon after the election. Tilden was one of the wealthiest men in the country at the time, having made most of his money as a corporate lawyer and Wall Street investor. He was strongly anti-slavery, and as a young man had been one of the founders of the Free Soil Movement of the 1840s, which sought to ban slavery from newly acquired territories. During the Civil War, Tilden was what was called a war Democrat, meaning that he supported Union efforts to win the war, but opposed some of the Lincoln administration's more draconian efforts to limit political dissent and personal freedom, which Tilden considered unjust and arbitrary impositions. Following the war, Tilden became active in Democratic Party politics in New York and was campaign manager for former New York Governor Horatio Seymour when he ran for president against Grant in 1868. Following his battle with Boss Tweed and Tammany Hall, Tilden was elected governor on his own in 1874, and as head of the most populous state in the country, he was a natural choice to be the Democratic candidate for president in 1876. When the campaign started, Tilden and the Democrats hoped to make reform their big campaign issue, and thus saddle Hayes and Republicans with the need to defend Grant and his sorry ring of old army buddies, tax-evading whiskey distillers, bribe-taking secretaries of war, and other assorted thieves and incompetents. The Republicans, however, were smart enough to change the subject. Hayes himself was personally incorruptible, if rather bland, and so they soon made the campaign yet another referendum on the efficiency and staying power of the bloody shirt. Waving the bloody shirt, as you may know, is political shorthand for dredging up the Civil War and blaming the Democrats for everything that had taken place before, during, and after the war.
So once again, what we see is a similarity on a certain level of how they approach the particular elections. Tilden's strategy, the Democrat, was to focus in on what? Reforms. And talk about the particular abuses that the Republicans had been engaged in, you know, the bribery, the various scandals, so on and so forth. He was a war Democrat, kind of like today, where they pretend that they are against some of the natural occurrences that happen during wars, i.e. stripping of civil rights, but support the war at the same time. Sound familiar? But at the same time, part of the trick is to get that these guys play is by getting into a game of personal attacks and trying to do a personal characterization of the party, i.e. give the Republicans a particular image and give the Democrats a certain image, that they want to get the masses caught into a game where you think that your salvation is aligning with a party that you more socially, morally, quote unquote, identify with or think you identify with. See, it has nothing to do with class. It's just these types of games that they play. And in the same way that rumors were running around about Tilden possibly being gay, so, of course, he had to counteract that aspect because in this type of society, they could play up these types of things and use it as an attack on your particular character. When in reality, it's the whole privatized market system that both of them are really gaily in bed with, Democrats and Republicans. It's the privatized order. The whole market order that's at the heart of the misery, that helped explode out the contradictions that thus became the Civil War, that's part, that was the cornerstone of the slave system, that was a cornerstone of the evaporation of the native aboriginals as expanders in this privatized order kept marching on their privatized expansion, manifest destiny over the territory of the native inhabitants. That's the cornerstone. But see, the reality is that the Democrats and Republicans are all administrators for that type of market order. So they'll want you to get into looking at any other thing then and now other than your own personal exploitation as someone on Sam's plantation. Now, as the issue kept heating up around the time, and of course the South, they were mixing in the Southern Democrats, issues of white pride and deliverance, with of course some white gunpowder, and in a Mississippi newspaper, they this is what they basically said was their more or less mission and consensus amongst the people, and that was, quote, a white man's government by white men for the benefit of white men. And then peacefully if we can, forcefully if we must. So this is all to maintain dominance in a white male ruling class order clique for the exploitation of who they choose and how they choose within this hierarchical setup. Now, here, let's go on as Morris talks about the dynamics that were really firing up in the South after the end of the Civil War, as we've been alluding to. Check this out.
For the better part of a decade after the Civil War, Union troops, federal troops, had been stationed throughout the South to protect Republican office holders, many of them so-called carpetbaggers from the North, who had taken political power during the period in which large numbers of Democrats were prohibited from voting or holding public office due to their prior service in the Confederate Army. At the same time, hundreds of thousands of former slaves were able to vote for the first time in their lives. And not surprisingly, they voted overwhelmingly for the Republican candidates whose party had fought to free them in the first place. Southern whites felt rightly or wrongly that they were being unfairly persecuted by this, and they were determined to retake political control of their own region. The Ku Klux Klan and other Southern terrorist groups grew out of this desire to throw off carpetbag rule and redeem the various southern states from Republican control. By 1876, all but three southern states had been so redeemed, and it's no coincidence that those three states, Florida, Louisiana, and South Carolina, would play an enormous role in the 1876 election. So tensions were high on both sides during the campaign. There were several racial incidents in South Carolina prior to the election, including a pitched gun battle on the 4th of July in Hamburg, South Carolina, between black townspeople of Hamburg and white militiamen from Augusta, Georgia, right across the Savannah River. The Hamburg massacre, in fact, became a rallying cry for Republicans across the country. But actually, the worst violence in South Carolina took place between black supporters of Hayes and black supporters of Tilden.
Which basically was just some buy-off Negroes. Kind of what's going to happen this time around, you know, when we have to more or less deal with some of the Negroes who will be insisting on holding on to both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party as we're trying to choke Sam to death. They'll be running on Master's plantation trying to stop us. Well, we got something for them. But other than that, you have a situation where it's interesting how those who have been injected with a hierarchical belief system. And one of the hierarchical belief systems is whiteness itself. When large portions of the European population started to see themselves as white, even though many of them were just dirt poor Europeans, they started to identify with the construct of whiteness that was constructed by elite white men who constructed it so that they wouldn't identify with the black masses who often they were toiling in the dirt right next to, not in literally slave conditions, but in another form of indentured servitude, subhuman conditions. But when the white elite constructed the construct of whiteness and then put out this broad net and then gave, you know, a few extra crumbs to these European peasants, you had it, these people adopt an ideology that was not only a social construct, but a political, economic, economic one, psychological, and patriarchal, patriarchal one. So women, white women now, formerly from wherever in Europe, who now bought into it, were in effect buying into a patriarchal, a white male patriarchal construct. So they were basically being patriarchal women. And still, you know, the vast majority are today, even though they don't know it. Now, the reason why I mention this is that this element of an economic construct is a form of a class alignment. A racialized white elite constructed class alignment for a specific group of people. And this has been one of the barriers that since many people in this society are injected in that construct of whiteness from not identifying with other exploited laborers of a darker hue. So here you have a situation where in New Orleans, when the madness kept going on, Sheridan, General Sheridan, and yeah, this is the same Sheridan, Mad Dog Sheridan, who was a noted orchestrator for, you know, killing Indians, sent Custer back on his way to kill some more Indians after Custer had been reprimanded for, you know, wandering off on one expedition and going bear hunting and stuff like that. The same Sheridan that said the bit about, you know, the only good Indian being a dead one and so on and so forth. Well, he was sent in with an armed force into one of the districts at the National House of Representatives because of a lot of the chaos that was going on, basically by, you know, white and white Democrats trying to seize and maintain their elite power. Now, of course, Sheridan, just like Lincoln, was no real friend of black people. They were just trying to maintain the Union. That's what this was all about. Maintain the sovereignty and cohesiveness as much as they could of the states, because that allows them to expand down the road more force and power throughout the hemisphere. But when Sheridan did come in with armed troops, it's kind of interesting how, like, the New Orleans Daily Pectrune said this, quote, For the first time in the history of the United States, armed soldiers have invaded a legislative hall, and bayonets have been used to expel the representatives of the people from their seats. So they go in, you know, because Sheridan made his move and stuff. But what's fascinating is here, many of these white folks who love to talk about patriotism and all of that type of stuff, these white folks of the South revolted against the Union itself. They picked up the gun, elected their own president, you know, or had, you know, followed their own president, Jefferson Davis, and went on the war path, which caused hundreds of thousands of lives. Now, personally, it would have been best if the Civil War had been completed and the United States as we know it would have been collapsed and wiped off. But unfortunately, that didn't happen. But my whole point is that here, many of them and their uncles and fathers and so on and so forth, because this is just a few years after the Civil War, were engaged in an armed revolt. And now all of a sudden they want to get all high and mighty about what another hoodlum, Sheridan, has done. That just shows the moxie that these guys have and their whole mentality in general. But here, let's break down as these events lead up to the election period. Let's break down the stolen election events in this whole presidential race and how they unfolded.
Tilden seemed like a good bet to win the White House when voters went to the polls on November 7th. In fact, both he and Hayes went to bed on election night thinking that Tilden had won. Tilden was by then 250,000 votes ahead in the popular count and needed only one more electoral vote to become the first Democrat elected president since James Buchanan in 1856. Lemonade Lucy was so distraught by the way the election was going that she left the gala victory party she was hosting in Columbus and went home to bed with a sick headache. Well, as we all know, there's no official portrait of President Samuel Tilden hanging in the White House. So, what happened? In a nutshell, Daniel Sickles happened, and everything else stemmed from that initial happening. Devil Dan Sickles, as he was known to his contemporaries, is largely forgotten today, but he was one of the most controversial figures of his era. A wealthy New York congressman before the Civil War, Sickles at the time was considered a rising star in the Democratic Party. In fact, he was a protege of James Buchanan when Buchanan was president. But Sickles' political career went into abrupt eclipse after he murdered his wife's lover, Philip Barton Key, the son of Star Spangled Banner composer Francis Scott Key, within earshot of the White House. With the help of a dream team of high-powered Washington attorneys, including Abraham Lincoln's future Secretary of War, Edwin Stanton, Sickles was found not guilty by reason of temporary insanity, which is the first time such a legal defense had been used successfully in an American court of law. Following the trial, Sickles went home to New York, where he lived more or less peacefully for the next few years. When the war began, he raised and equipped a brigade of Union infantry. They came near to single-handedly losing the Battle of Gettysburg by disobeying orders and moving his troops directly into the line of fire. Only the fact that he lost a leg that same day to a Confederate cannonball prevented Sickles from being summarily court-martialed and tossed out of the army. Instead, he was awarded a Medal of Honor for his troubles. And during the Grant administration, he was appointed secretary to Spain, minister to Spain, in which his notorious love affair with deposed Queen Isabella II earned him the new nickname, the Yankee King of Spain. On election night, after the two candidates had already gone to bed thinking Tilden had won the election, Sickles made a fateful decision to stop by Republican headquarters at the Fifth Avenue Hotel in New York City. Sickles happened to live a few doors down from the hotel himself, and he decided to look in and see how the election was going. It was going very badly, said National Committee Clerk N.C. Clancy, who was the only one still there. Clancy was in the process of packing up the Republican Party records, and he said that Party Chairman Zachariah Chandler had already gone to bed with a bottle of whiskey. Sickles refused to believe it, not that Chandler would go to bed with a bottle of whiskey, but that Tilden had won the election. He sat down at Chandler's desk and looked through various telegrams and election returns, and then had nothing less than a political brainstorm. Sickles saw that if Hayes could somehow claim the electoral votes from Florida, Louisiana, and South Carolina, where the three states where Republican governors were still in power, he would win the election by one electoral vote, 185 to 184. It didn't matter to Sickles that Tilden was still a quarter of a million votes ahead, which translates in modern figures to about 1.3 million votes. As we all remember from the 2000 election, only electoral votes count in the end. And Sickles sent telegrams to the Republican governors of the three states in question, telling them not to concede anything to the Democrats and promising them that troops and money would be furnished as needed by the Grant administration. Then Sickles went home and went to bed, having set into motion perhaps the greatest political swindle in American history. The next morning, every major newspaper in the country, except the New York Times, was calling Tilden the winner. The Chicago Tribune, which 72 years later would win a measure of unwanted immortality with its famous headline, "Dewey Defeats Truman," mirrored the mood of most Republican papers at the time. The Tribune said, "Lost, the country given over to Democratic greed and plunder." The New York Times, though, was still calling it a doubtful election. This was primarily because Times managing editor John C. Reed, a dyed in the wool Republican himself, had also turned up at the Fifth Avenue Hotel the night before, just a few minutes after Sickles left. Reed found copies of Sickles' telegrams on Chandler's desk. Reed himself was a former Union cavalryman who had been imprisoned in the infamous Libby prison in Richmond during the Civil War, so he was very much anti-democratic. He rushed upstairs to Zachariah Chandler's apartment, woke him up, showed him Sickles' telegrams, and tried to tell him what they should do next. Chandler was either too sleepy or too drunk to realize what was going on, but he told Reed to do what he wanted. He was going back to bed.
So once again, this highlights that these types of swindles, corruption, manipulation, all of that within the American system, these are not aberrations. This is part and parcel of those who are committed to power by any means. You can just see the whole fabric of the American society kind of play itself out if you step back and take a look at the events that are taking place during this time. Here you have Democrats and Republicans battling to serve the Orthodox. All sides are as corrupt as can be. Briberies, swindles, everything you can imagine is going on. The country in 1873 plunges itself into its Great Depression from no other factor than the way the whole market privatized system is set up. Their response, more deprivation, i.e. an expansion of their genocidal campaign on the native aboriginals, especially in the Dakota areas, which set off a next chain of horrific actions that in part culminated in the massacre during the Ghost Dance. And this is after all the other collapses of the infrastructure of the lives of the native people in that region that just got overwhelmed. Red Cloud had already, long before, gone on to the plantation, putting away his war robes, and the destruction eventually of Sitting Bull, Crazy Horse, and others is also documented in this sad scale of events. But during that whole time also, the domination and destruction of black folks and some of their newly gained rights is taking place on a massive level. As we've gone into concerning the various terroristic groups, the White Line, the Klan, Men of Justice, White Brotherhood, White Camellia, Black Cavalry, Red Shirts, Rising Sun, all that junk that these sadistic barbarians were engaged in. So every aspect that you can look at, you can see just complete warfare taking place to subjugate the masses of people into the compartment that more or less became part of the American experience and experiment that is as ruthless and as barbaric as any in the history of humanity. So, Sickles, just some little, you know, thug who doesn't even know how to carry out a battle without disobeying, quote-unquote, the little commands that the little Joes were engaged in, he sets up the next scheme of stolen elections. Because for them, theft is a way of life. From stealing Africans, to stealing land from the natives, to stealing elections. What's the big deal? So now let's go into the strategies that were played out by the various three states that were quote-unquote told to hold up on their electoral acknowledgement, that being, of course, Louisiana, Florida, and the other, what was that other, and the third one. I'll think of it in a second. But let's just go into the three state situation that took place.
So Reed went to Western Union and sent new telegrams to the three southern states telling the governors there to hold on to your states, troops and money will be furnished. Well, by the time Samuel Tilden woke up the next morning, he was no longer president-elect. In fact, for the next 4 months, no one was really president-elect. It took many long, tedious weeks of congressional hearings, legal proceedings, vote counting, vote recounting, double dealing, bribe taking, and political compromising to determine the ultimate outcome of the election. Zachariah Chandler, by the way, got up the day after the election and issued a terse statement in which he said Hayes has 185 votes and is elected. At first, Hayes himself didn't get the message. "I think we're defeated," Hayes told reporters in Columbus. "I'm of the opinion that the Democrats have carried the country and elected Tilden." Privately, Ulysses S. Grant had come to the same conclusion, although he was prudent enough to keep such opinions to himself. Hayes was quickly told to do the same thing, and soon he was telling friends that he had no doubt that he had been legally and justly elected. As for Tilden, he simply couldn't believe that anyone looking at the final vote counts could claim with a straight face that Hayes had been elected president instead of him. "The fiery zealots of the Republican Party may attempt to count me out," he said, "but I don't think the better class of Republicans will permit it." Well, in this, he had a somewhat higher opinion of his opponents than they had of themselves. Because even while he was appealing to the public sense of justice, dozens of Republican visiting statesmen were rushing down to the three disputed southern states, Florida, Louisiana, and South Carolina. For the next several weeks, they virtually took over the state capitals in Columbia, New Orleans, and Tallahassee, standing by to give any moral, political, or financial assistance necessary to their fellow party members on the ground.
Now, what's fascinating, you know, you have a situation where, if you look at the situation, how it unfolded, you had the three states, Florida, Louisiana, and South Carolina. These are southern states. So along with the double dealing that Morse was talking about, the bribery, of course, the C word, compromise, comes in. Now, this is all to, quote unquote, maintain order, but that's within the context of a ruling elite clique for the maintenance and dominance, as seen by those of privilege. And at the hierarchical top, of course, is white male privilege. So that's what they're mainly talking about. And within that context, as that stuff played out in the compromise, what's fascinating is that while that caused a lot of consternation because it shook people's image and all of that type of stuff about the state, the society, etc., just like, you know, the JFK thing supposed to have shook a lot of people up on, you know, the moral foundation of this society. If you look at the 2000 election, there was less shame about the theft in the 2000 election that historically took place after the 1876 election. In other words, you could see it, an evaporation of many people's expectation within this society. And you can see how also the corporate media in today's terms help facilitate this type of takeover with how they played out the let's just move on. You know, Mr. Hoard Gore is conceded, just move on, and on and on. Now, if you take that context of we must move on, you know, this is supposed to be the embetterment of the society, that's a similar mentality and direction that was played out after Boy George and company decided to streamline this current war in Iraq. That, okay, that's already been done, they're already engaged, they're in action now, so you all must get behind the leader. Get behind the G.I. Joe troops. Because once the decision is made, regardless of how corrupt, no matter how much manipulation took place, no matter how vile it is, no matter how many lives may be destroyed in the case of Iraq, in this current war, in the case of black folks, the election and the compromise, and part of the compromise, as we know, was the compromise of Reconstruction. There was a drawback and basically a throwing up of the hands by the Republicans who, for them to be able to facilitate their theft of the election, they more or less conceded to let the South, or the whites in the South, just have what they want concerning the dominating control of black folks in the South. So thereby more or less being the final nail in the coffin of the Reconstruction period, which then helped facilitate the next period and stage of Jim Crowism, domination, super expansion of lynchings, and immiseration of black folks. Now, let's go into how this disputed election played out in the land of justice. Dig this.
Very briefly, what happened was that the Republican controlled canvassing board simply threw out enough Tilden votes to make Hayes the winner.
Primarily, these things were done on the grounds that the Democrats had unfairly intimidated black voters before the election. The Democratic governors-elect turned around and signed certificates naming Tilden the winner, and both sets of documents were sent to Washington to be opened when the Electoral College officially met in early December. When Congress formally convened, it was faced with the problem of what to do with the two opposing sets of certificates. The Constitution itself was no help. The 12th Amendment, which had been passed in 1804 after the disputed election between Thomas Jefferson and Aaron Burr 4 years earlier, simply directed the President of the Senate to open all the certificates and the votes shall then be counted. The Republicans argued that this meant that Republican Senator Thomas Ferry, who had become acting President of the Senate when Vice President Henry Wilson died the year before, was entitled to decide which votes to count. The Democrats, who control the House of Representatives, argued that Wilson could only open the ballots and set aside any competing ballots, which would have meant that neither Hayes nor Tilden had an effective electoral majority, in which case the election would have been thrown into the House of Representatives and Tilden would have immediately been elected president. Well, for understandable reasons, neither side would budge from their initial position. To resolve the impasse, a special bipartisan electoral commission was appointed, the only one we've had in American history, and they were supposed to rule on which candidate would get the disputed votes from Florida, South Carolina, and Louisiana. The commission was comprised of 5 senators, 5 congressmen, and 5 Supreme Court justices. In theory, it was supposed to be evenly split with 7 Democrats, 7 Republicans, and 1 independent. But the one independent, Supreme Court Justice David Davis of Illinois, resigned to take a seat in the U.S. Senate. And his place was filled by a Republican Supreme Court Justice, Joseph Bradley of New Jersey. After several weeks of what amounted to largely pro forma hearings, the commission, voting strictly along party lines, ruled in a series of 8-7 votes that Hayes was entitled to all the electoral votes from the 3 states, making him formally the president-elect. After the commission had ruled, one Democratic newspaper said, "The monster fraud of the century has just been consummated." While all these hearings were going on in Washington, this country large was in a state of turmoil. All sorts of wild rumors were running about that secret Democratic armies were being formed to march on Washington and seat Tilden by force if necessary. These so-called armies had ominous-sounding names like the Sons of Liberty, the Knights of the Golden Circle, the Tilden Minutemen. Democratic newspapers were calling for Tilden or blood. Tilden, for his part, downplayed any consideration of violence, although he did give brief consideration to naming former Union General George B. McClellan his military attaché. Back in the White House, President Grant took the rumors seriously enough to bring reinforcements into Washington and place troops at strategic locations around the city. At the same time, the USS Wyoming began sailing up and down the Potomac River on the lookout for the oncoming Democratic Army. Well, in the end, things were settled peacefully, if not necessarily fairly. And Rutherford B. Hayes, not Samuel Tilden, arrived in Washington on March 3, 1877, to be inaugurated the 19th President of the United States.
Now, some of this helps point out the contradictions that many of the slaves of the society find themselves in. Because as you heard Morris talk about in his closing statement on this aspect of how the election played out, that in the end, the issue was the elections concerning the issues concerning the elections was played out and settled peacefully. But for black folks, that wasn't the end. That was just the new beginning of terrorism. The various terrorist groups, like the Klan, really then started to spread their wings more. The various forms of gun control laws were ratcheted up more to re-disenfranchise from owning arms, like during the slave days of black folks, so the means of self-defense would be stricken from them, and their terroristic Armageddon warpath could continue. The Indians, of course, were in a battle for their existence in the regions where they weren't already completely extinguished from their normal way. So the empire, well, the American experiment, I should say, was still expanding its fangs throughout the region and within the necks of its subjects, like it has always done and will always do, as long as this entity is in existence. Now, let's go into the secret deal by these Republicans and Democrats. Dig this.
As part of a secret understanding between Hayes's people and a small group of Southern Democrats in Congress, Hayes agreed to remove the last federal troops from the South, in effect ending Reconstruction. In return, the Southern Democrats agreed not to filibuster against Hayes's inauguration. This secret meeting at the Wormley Hotel in Washington effectively did put an end to Reconstruction, and everyone went home happy except for Tilden, the 4.5 million voters who voted for Tilden, and the roughly equal number of African Americans in the South who were subsequently abandoned by the Republican Party and left to languish in the racial and political wilderness there for the next 90 years. In the long run, was it all worth it? Probably not. Rutherford B. Hayes was no one's idea of George Washington or Abraham Lincoln, and Samuel Tilden was no one's idea of Thomas Jefferson or Andrew Jackson. Both Hayes and Tilden were comparatively decent men, particularly by the rock-bottom standards of the Gilded Age. They were both socially conservative, racially moderate, and fiscally sound. It was hard then, and it's hard now, to find a lot to choose from between them. The crucial difference, I think, is that Tilden was the one who was really elected. Most people, probably even Hayes himself in his heart of hearts, believed the same thing, and it left a stain on Hayes' presidency and on the entire American political process that will never entirely wash out. Ever afterwards, Hayes himself was known to at least half the country as Rutherfraud B. Hayes, his fraudulency, the great usurper, or old 8-7.
But in reality, the whole system is a fraud. And that's why it's beyond just personalizing it. Was it worth it? Is the American experiment worth it? No. Not for the slaves, at least. Now, here's a little bit within the fraud of the century, going into some of the aspects that took place in Louisiana. It goes, in Louisiana, too, there was surprisingly little violence before the election. Indeed, Louisiana Democrats made a concerted and somewhat successful effort to appeal to black voters who had grown increasingly disgusted by years of Republican misrule and neglect. The Democratic nominee for governor, former Confederate General Francis R. T. Nichols, had impeccable credentials for making such an appeal. He had lost his left arm at Winchester and his left foot at Chancellorsville. As he had been carried from the field following his second wound, Nichols joked gallantly that his lifelong ambition to be a judge had been ruined. Quote, "As henceforth I shall be a one-sided man," unquote. Ennobled by his suffering, Nichols could afford to reach out to black voters without fear that he would appear weak or traitorous to his white supporters. One similarly wounded veteran assured the candidates, quote, "General, all what's left of me is going to vote for all what's left of you, unquote. Let me stop right there for a sec. Now, this shows how there's always been a stream of manipulation and just an aspect of image and kind of a character imagery being the production of who you should quote unquote support. In other words, not just support what's really truly in your own interest. Look at these figureheads, align yourself into a mentality that has you going on someone's so-called charisma that is basically a component of the state apparatus. So here, this Louisiana Democrat who basically fought to help keep black people enslaved loses a foot and an arm, and all of a sudden he's supposed to have some kind of gallant character about him because he fought in a war for your subjugation. I mean, the way things are manipulated. Now, of course, you had a situation where, in the same way that black folks in now times are obviously disenfranchised because they don't serve their interests, they're being more and more disenfranchised from the Democrats. You see Republicans trying to make an appeal to them and try to do a balancing act to maintain their white base of voters. Back then, here, the Republicans were catching more and more of the ire of black folks who wanted to see more progress be made during the Reconstruction period. They're being frustrated. So the raggedy Democrats come in with this hocus-pocus trick. And it was a hocus-pocus trick because once the deal was made, black people were, as Morris and everyone knows, were completely abandoned, and the vicious tyranny of white folks in the South who were a part of the dominating Führer of white expansionist elitism just went buck wild with the Jim Crows and all these other things, the form of terror, lynchings, collective guilt, when you making postcards of people that they lynched, breaking up their burnt charred body parts and putting them into little jars and selling them at dime stores. This is sending out a message that however imaginative you are, you can never imagine how brutal and barbaric will be if you Negroes ever think about lifting up your head again. That's in part what all of that extremely sadistic type of cruelty that befell upon. And considering Louisiana, and considering more in particular what just took place in New Orleans, Hurricane Sam, one can see how we just been going around in circles in many ways. Now, as we wrap this up, let's hear Morris talk more or less about the similarity between the Democratic Tilden, who made his more or less bowing out in the quote-unquote respectable way, i.e. not challenging the legitimacy of the whole system, and the way another Democrat years later, Al Gore, did something quite similar. Dig this.
If Tilden was embittered by this remarkable experience, he never showed it personally. One of his few public statements after the election He told the Manhattan Club, "Everybody knows that after the recent election, the men who were elected were counted out, and the men who were not elected were counted in. If my voice could reach throughout the country and be heard in the remotest hamlet, I would say, be of good cheer. The Republic will live. The institutions of our fathers will not expire in shame. The sovereignty of the people shall be rescued from this peril and reestablished." We can only hope that Tilden was right.
Of course he wasn't right. But when you have an empire that has no shame, what can you expect? In the 2000 election in the aftermath, or even before, the election was conceded. Gore had information, just like the Democratic Party, about the stolen election and how it took place. The corporate media was sent information about how Jeb Bush and Katherine Harris had manipulated software to help facilitate the theft of the election in Florida. The corporate media, for the quote-unquote embetterment of the state and the legitimacy of the state, looked the other way. And Al Gore did the same and basically gave a similar Cheerios type of speech in his concession to Boy George. Gabbled down later, some Negroes in the Black Congress who wanted simply an investigation, because any real insight or investigation on just how truly barbaric this system really is and how corrupted at the core is considered a threat and problematic. From honestly looking at what happened in 1963 in November when JFK caught a bullet in his head, to what happened on 9/11 2001, to a host of other things, from the stolen election in 1876 to the stolen elections in 2000 and 2004, to the stolen sovereignty of Iraqis starting in 2003. The game's all the same for an empire that has no shame and has a contempt for true justice. That is, until those at the helm are put in their final proper resting place. Until the next time, slave out.